From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now in Atlanta today. The focus is on the funeral of Congressman John Lewis. And among those present, three former presidents, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. In a few minutes, we'll hear some moments from today's service and reflections on Lewis's life.
But first, we have a stark indication of the toll the COVID-19 pandemic is taking on the U.S. economy. The Commerce Department reported this morning that the nation's output of goods and services fell at an annual rate of nearly 33%. This is the steepest quarterly contraction of the U.S. economy in modern history. We're joined now by Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, we've had a lot of worrisome economic reports since the pandemic, but I wonder if you could put in context this snapshot of an economy that appears to be in free fall.
Yeah, this is the biggest one. GDP, it's not something people sort of think about all the time, but it is the most complete and biggest measure of all economic activity, everything that we produce in this country. The drop in production is the biggest since the Second World War. In fact, even in the Second World War, the record was 10%. Since the Second World War in 1958, we saw 10%. So during the entirety of the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, GDP fell 4%, and it took 18 months to reach that level. This is upward of 30%, and in less than 5 months this year, 54.1 million people filed for unemployment claims. So that means they either lost their job or were laid off or furloughed. We now have 19 weeks in a row that the U.S. has seen more than a million people looking for claims. So this directly obviously relates to coronavirus. The more infections there are, the more illness there is, the more closures there are, and the fewer people working.
And we're seeing that Germany's economy contracted 10% in its second quarter. How does the U.S. compare to most other industrialized countries?
Well, this is the highest number of global economies that are shrinking economically since 1870. So, in fact, it's, again, bigger than even the Great Depression. This is according to the World Bank. The share is going to be more than 90% of countries are going to see their economies shrink. Singapore, for instance, a place that has handled coronavirus initially fairly well and then saw a rebound, they dropped by 41% in the second quarter. In Latin America, Mexico dropped by 17.3%, Colombia by 16%. There is growth in China because China got hit so early that by the second quarter, which is the second 3 months of the year, they had started reopening. So China was actually up 3.2%. But generally speaking, most countries are down.
Are there any indications that we are beginning to dig our way out of the hole?
Well, there was a bit of a recovery underway. It was very, very small, and the Fed chair says that the data indicates that we are slowing in the recovery. According to a survey from the Conference Board, 1 in 5 people expect things to worsen. 60% of restaurants have closed since March 1st, and those closures will be permanent. 40 major retailers have filed for bankruptcy this year. The record in 2010 was 48. So we're maybe in the fourth inning of this thing at the moment.
The Congressional Budget Office has predicted a strong pickup in growth in the second half of this year. I wonder if a recovery could happen in that time, given how far we've fallen. Is that practical?
No, and particularly with the increase in cases and deaths around the country, that looks pretty optimistic. The more recent prediction we got was from the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, yesterday, and he said, the path forward for the economy is extraordinarily uncertain and will depend on the success in keeping the virus in check. So the issue here is it's not really an economic problem, it's a virus problem, and until it's in check, we're not going to be able to talk about a recovery.
And meanwhile, this comes as negotiations over the latest relief bill have stalled in Congress. Do you think these reports could spur on Congress and the White House
Yes.
to take action?
Yes. First of all, it'll affect
Good.
The stock market, which the White House does tend to focus on. And yes, the seriousness of this will probably spur them to get back into meetings to come up with some solution to this.
And by the way, if that happens, how soon do people out there reap any benefits? Because states have to act in the meantime.
That's the problem. We've already missed the deadline for states to retool. So even if Congress came up with something, let's say by the weekend that they voted on next week, it may be 2 to 3 weeks before that extra $600 gets to, or whatever the amount of money is, gets to people who've been on unemployment. So that'll be a delay. And remember, the moratorium on evicting people or beginning eviction processes or foreclosure processes has ended. So unless Congress fixes that, there are a lot of people who haven't paid rent for 4 months who are going to be hit by a big rent bill or a big mortgage bill. So those are two things that Congress has to fix immediately.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
New regulations on the tech industry could be one step closer today after members of the House Judiciary Committee got a rare chance to question four of the world's most powerful businessmen yesterday. The heads of Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook all sat for questions via video link in a six-hour session of the House Antitrust Subcommittee. We should mention that all four companies are financial sponsors of NPR. Shireen Ghaffari was watching the hearing. She's a reporter with Recode and joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks.
And let's start with Amazon, because this was the first ever testimony before Congress by the CEO, Jeff Bezos, who, by the way, is the richest person on earth. And he was asked how the company treats third-party sellers on its platform. Representative Lucy McBath, Democrat of Georgia, played a recording of one bookseller who claimed Amazon delisted her business for no reason and never replied to her inquiries. Let's listen.
Do you think this is an acceptable way to treat someone that you described as both a partner and a customer?
No, Congresswoman, and I appreciate you showing me that anecdote, and I would like to talk to her. It does not at all to me seem like the right way to treat her, and I'm surprised by that. And it's not the systematic approach that we take, I can assure you.
How did that go over, and what did the committee have to say about Amazon in general?
Well, you're seeing the committee sort of present a different reality at times to Bezos than the one that he's familiar with about what it's like for these independent sellers to try to sell their products on Amazon. The committee presented Bezos with cases of sellers who have complained that at first their business runs okay on Amazon, but once they start doing really well, that all of a sudden they're not able to reach their customers. And so Congress members were really questioning Bezos about, are these really just one-off anecdotes like you're telling us, or is there a systematic pattern here of Amazon tilting the scales in its favor?
Let's talk about Facebook. Members of Congress had emails from CEO Mark Zuckerberg about the company's 2012 acquisition of Instagram. And Jerry Nadler, the chair, the Democrat of New York, said that purchase may have been illegal if it was done to bump off competition. Listen.
In your own words, you purchased Instagram to neutralize a competitive threat. If this was an illegal merger at the time of the transaction, why shouldn't Instagram now be broken off into a separate company?
Well, Congressman, I think the FTC had all of these documents and reviewed this and unanimously voted at the time not to challenge the acquisition. I mean, I think with hindsight, it probably looks like obvious that Instagram would have reached the scale that it has today, but at the time it was far from obvious.
Zuckerberg was also asked about copying competitors' products. Tell us about the case lawmakers were making against Facebook.
Right. So the case there is that Facebook has what Congressmember Jayapal called copy, acquire, kill strategy, something that Facebook uses to sort of first imitate their competitors and then allegedly strong arm them into a deal. And so that's what the line of questioning focused on there with Facebook and Instagram in particular. And Facebook, of course, denies this and says that when they acquired Instagram, it was not at all clear that Instagram would be as wildly successful as it is today, and that overall they help businesses when they acquire them.
With all these CEOs there for this hearing from these big companies, who would you say was the one that the members of Congress wanted to go after the most?
I would say that both Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, as well as Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, faced some of the most tough and persistent lines of questioning yesterday. I think that Google is the one that has the most imminent potential regulation or action coming its way, because there is a Department of Justice lawsuit expected to be filed this summer. And Zuckerberg, of course, because there were kind of new documents and new findings that the committee put forward that they had out of this one-year investigation into Facebook's business practices around this copy, kill, acquire theory. So I think that you saw both of those two leaders really be in the hot seat yesterday.
And do you expect some new regulations to come out of what's going on in Congress right now?
look, I don't think we're going to see any changes overnight. I think, you know, especially the Republican focus on this question of political bias was very much a sign that Republicans and Democrats care about some pretty different issues in terms of how to go after these tech companies. The line of questioning around this alleged bias was frustrating to Democrats who wanted to focus the conversation about antitrust, about are these companies, do they have too much monopoly power? Whereas questions about political bias are a little bit of a diversion from that focus, at least in the eyes of Democrats. However, I do think that a hearing like this is important. It's a rare way to kind of hold these leaders accountable and have people asking them tough questions under oath, and does potentially kind of open up some lines of questioning about regulatory practices in the future.
That is Recode reporter Shireen Ghaffari, who was paying close attention yesterday to this big hearing in the House Antitrust Subcommittee with a number of the big tech CEOs. Shireen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Congressman John Lewis is being remembered at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta today. He died earlier this month after more than 30 years in Congress, and before that was a giant in the civil rights movement. In a moment, we're going to hear some extended clips from today's funeral. But first, for a look at his legacy, we're joined by Peniel Joseph, director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas, Austin. Professor, you write that as a young activist, John Lewis navigated between two groups, those seeking dramatic change and others seeking change through the Democratic Party. How did he walk that line?
Well, you know, John is somebody who had so much integrity. So even when people disagreed with him, they knew that he had personal sincerity. And really, as chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, he did walk that line between those who wanted a political revolution and then those who were more interested in incremental change through policy, legislation, legal decisions. And I think you could see in his embrace of the Black Lives Matter movement, even though he himself was somebody who I would consider this nonviolent, militant pragmatist, he understood the concerns of revolutionaries, and he was willing to embrace those revolutionaries, even if he disagreed with their tactics. So I think that as an older generation, he was 80 years old when he passed, instead of castigating BLM activists, he said, look, you women and men are working the tradition of Dr. King and the beloved community. And all he stressed was that nonviolent civil disobedience was the best tactic to bring about the new world that they wanted.
Well, and in fact, his own words are printed in the New York Times today, words that he wrote before he died and asked to be published on the day of his funeral. He said that he recently visited the Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington right before he was admitted to the hospital. And he says, quote, I just had to see and feel it for myself that after many years of silent witness, the truth is still marching on.
Yeah, and I think that he's a perfect example of the fluidity between these movements, because when BLM first happened in 2013, many critics were saying this is not what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement would have done, when in fact it was exactly what they had done. And I think we are understanding much more better there is a river. There's a river of activism that flows from the civil rights movement in the 1960s and John Lewis all the way to the BLM movement in 2020. And it's remarkable that Congressman Lewis got to see the arc of that river of activism.
What do you think of the fact that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, is not at the funeral today, but other former presidents are? In fact, the eulogy is coming from President Obama.
Well, I think it's disappointing, but I think it definitely showcases where we're at in 2020 with these real political divisions that center around race. The consensus that had been created in part through John Lewis's activism that American presidents made the concerted rhetorical effort, whether we're thinking about Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, both Bushes and Clinton and Obama, that racial justice was central to American democracy. We see that by 2017, that consensus has really been riven. And part of the debates that we're having, the conflicts, the demonstrations are really based upon wanting to build a new consensus about what does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to be a citizen? What does democracy and freedom and dignity actually mean. And certainly we all know that Congressman Lewis, who is considered the conscience of the Congress, really reflects that beloved community. And he paid for it with the scars on his skull and his head and around his body. He was beaten not only at the Edmund Pettus Bridge on March 7th, 1965. He was beaten viciously in May of 1961 as well as a freedom rider. So he is emblematic of what we call the beloved community. And I think that this op-ed that he wrote shows that he believed that 2020 was offering all of us this generational opportunity for change, to end systemic racism, to defeat white supremacy, and to finally achieve our country.
That is Peniel Joseph, director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas, Austin. His book is called The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Bells tolled at the start of Congressman John Lewis's funeral today at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. And we're going to listen back now to some extended clips from the service, starting with former President George W. Bush, who spoke about the lesson that Congressman Lewis leaves behind.
His lesson for us is that we must all keep ourselves open to the hearing the call of love, the call of service, and the call to sacrifice for others. Listen, John and I had our disagreements, of course. But in the America John Lewis fought for, and the America I believe in, differences of opinion are inevitable elements and evidence of democracy in action. We, the people, including congressmen and presidents, can have differing views on how to perfect our union while sharing the conviction that our nation, however flawed, is at heart a good and noble one. We live in a better and nobler country today because of John Lewis and his abiding faith in the power of God, in the power of democracy, and in the power of love to lift us all to a higher ground. The story that began in Troy isn't ending here today, nor is the work. John Lewis lives forever in his father's house, and he will live forever in the hearts of Americans who act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with their God. May the flights of angels see John Lewis to his rest, and may God bless the country he loved.
The Reverend Dr. Bernice King also spoke. She's the daughter of the late Martin Luther King Jr. Today she called for others to follow the lead of Congressman Lewis.
Grant us the capacity to follow his example, to fight injustice without bitterness and hostility, but with a righteous indignation. Oh God, as Elisha asked for a double portion of Elijah's anointing as he transitioned, let a double portion of what John Lewis's life was about fall on us in this hour so that we can continue to get in good trouble. Anoint us with a double portion in this generation to get into good trouble until there is radical reform in policing in our nation. Anoint us a double portion to get into good trouble until voter suppression is no longer a part of our body politic. Anoint us with a double portion to get into good trouble until there is an equitable distribution of wealth in this nation, until everyone has a livable wage and affordable housing and good health care. Anoint us, oh God, with a double portion to get into good trouble until all labor is treated with dignity. Grant us, oh Father, a double portion to get into good trouble until the school-to-prison pipeline is non-existent and every child gets an equitable education. Grant us, dear God, a double portion to get into good trouble until white supremacy around the world is uprooted and dismantled and all of our policies and everyday practices and behaviors no longer reflect white supremacy. Grant us a double portion, God, to get into good trouble until this nation truly becomes a compassionate nation.
Former President Bill Clinton also spoke. He brought up Lewis's march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama in the 60s.
We honor him because in Selma, on the third attempt, John and his comrades showed that sometimes you have to walk into the wind along with it. As he crossed the bridge and marched into Montgomery. But no matter what, John always kept walking to reach the beloved community. He got into a lot of good trouble along the way, but let's not forget, he also developed an absolutely uncanny ability to heal troubled waters. When he could have been angry and determined to cancel his adversaries, he tried to get converts instead. He thought the open hand was better than the clenched fist. He lived by the faith and promise of St. Paul, "Let us not grow weary in doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not lose heart." He never lost heart. He fought the good fight, he kept the faith, but we got our last letter today on the pages of the New York Times. Keep moving. It is so fitting on the day of his service, he leaves us our marching orders.
What do you do for Christ? Well,
former President Bill Clinton speaking today at the funeral of Congressman John Lewis.
Remember only what you do for Christ will last.
Coastal communities in Alaska have grown increasingly dependent on jobs that come during the 5-month-long cruise ship season. But ships aren't coming these days because of the pandemic, and most of the jobs have evaporated. Now a new program in the capital, Juneau, is trying to bridge the gap and is drawing inspiration from a program from the Great Depression era, the Civilian Conservation Corps. Here's Adeline Baxter from member station KTOO.
At Eagle Crest Ski Area, members of Juneau's new COVID-19 Conservation Corps gather outside the maintenance shed.
We've got a helicopter pilot, a hiking guide, a boat captain, you know, our mechanic.
Dave Scanlon is the Ski Hill's general manager. He says they had more than 40 applicants for just 10 crew positions.
It's really great diversity of people that have been affected by COVID, and their typical summer work just doesn't exist right now.
The Juneau Assembly approved $1 million in Federal CARES Act funding for the Conservation Corps in June. Some 30 local residents will gain employment at several different sites around town through most of the fall. At Eagle Crest, they'll focus on mountain biking trails. The goal is to eventually turn the ski mountain into a year-round destination. Scanlon says Juneau would like to attract more non-cruise tourism.
And by the time we've learned how to control the pandemic, hopefully we'll have this new infrastructure that'll be available and ready to welcome our visitors back to Juneau.
This is the second day of training for the ski area crew, and for many of them, it's the first time they've been around this type of equipment. Jessica Davis is one of the only women in the group. She's learning how to use a compactor on gravel.
It's a lot easier to move it around on flat ground than it appeared, but I'm sure getting up there and doing berms and stuff is going to be a whole other story.
Davis spent the last 4 summers captaining a whale watching boat.
I'm used to working up to 80-hour work weeks and just crazy hours, sometimes 2 a.m. starts in the morning. Just having a normal set schedule and having a 3-day weekend, it's going to be really nice.
She's been out of work since the tour company laid off most of its seasonal staff in mid-March. Juneau's unemployment rate was nearly 11% in May. That's normally the time of year when tourism is really picking up, bringing in thousands of temporary jobs for the 5-month season. Most of the non-resident workers that typically arrive in April and May never made it here because of the pandemic. Still, hundreds of local residents who rely on seasonal work, like teachers or ski area employees, were out of luck. Lee Hart runs the Alaska Outdoor Alliance, an organization that has been advocating for a statewide stimulus package to help tourism businesses and workers impacted by COVID-19. Hart hopes the Conservation Corps concept will help improve access to Alaska's wild places.
The conversation I'm having and I'm hearing other people having is, how does Alaska emerge from this? And how does the thinking change, if at all, about how we think about this and how we think about our economy and where the opportunities are?
Jennifer Davis, the boat captain, says she'll miss the water and seeing her favorite whales while she's up on the mountain this year. And the type of work will be an adjustment, too.
I'll go from drinking coffee in the wheelhouse to hiking up mountains and shoveling and hauling rocks and dirt and using heavy equipment. So, yeah, I'm excited for the change.
For Here and Now, I'm Adeline Baxter in Juneau.
When the coronavirus pandemic forced children to leave their classrooms, they had to quickly adapt to life without a lot of in-person interaction. Now they're sitting in limbo during a summer with very few open recreation centers or entertainment venues. Meanwhile, they wait to find out what school will look like for them in the fall. One of those kids is 10-year-old Khalil Williams, a student at Jesu Catholic School in Cleveland.
At first, I thought we would go back to school sooner, but once I saw the news and saw people, a lot of people dying, I just knew it became serious. I bet this is all the kids. First they were happy, and then 4 days later in the week, they wanted to go back to school. That was me. I miss my friends. I miss recess. I could go outside and play basketball, and I miss my teachers. The summer for me is going to be okay because our family might go to Cedar Point. But we won't have that much fun because some places might be closed for the whole year. So yeah, I was planning to go to Sky Zone, but yeah, that's not going to happen. I know that for sure. So yeah, I'm looking forward to getting out of the house and going to school. And my mom would be really happy to get me out of the house because she knows I'm very bored. I never been this bored in my life. My mom said I might go back to school at least 2 days or something like that. I really don't want to do no online schooling again. I would just be down, my face would be an upside down smile. I'm trying not to think about it. I'm trying to think about good stuff like my mom said, because she said if I think about good stuff happens. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Khalil Williams, a student at Jesu Catholic School in Cleveland. His story was produced by Jenny Hamill at WCPN IdeaStream. Okay, let's take a few minutes to talk about seaweed. Did you know that it can be part of your menu, even if it's not sushi night? Here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has been exploring the possibilities and joins me now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, and we're not talking about picking up seaweed at the beach and eating it. There are companies that cultivate seaweed, including one where you live in Maine. Tell us more.
Yes, it's true. People have been harvesting wild seaweed all over the world for years. And until recently, the only edible seaweed available in the U.S. was dried. Most of it came from Asian waters. And eating seaweed in Asian cultures is far more common. You mentioned sushi, seasoning miso soup, dashi. But there is a company right here in my home state of Maine called Atlantic Sea Farms. And its founder, Brianna Warner, has an uplifting story. And I think we need uplifting stories these days.
Yes.
According to Atlantic Sea Farm, they are the largest commercial seaweed farm in the U.S. They line grow seaweed in the ice cold Maine waters, and then they sell it frozen in pureed cubes and ready to eat strands. And they also make fermented products, and they're not dyed or dehydrated. So it's a very cool new innovation.
And a lot of listeners may be familiar with nori, which is the kind of dry seaweed that is often used to wrap up sushi. But there are a lot of other kinds that people can try. Tell us about a few of them.
Yeah, there are many varieties of dried seaweed. Arame is a dark brown Japanese kelp with long, fine strands and a sweet, mild flavor. Dulse is pinkish maroon. It's usually sold in flake form, and that's almost meaty and chewy and salty. And then there's, of course, kelp. It's also known as kombu, the Japanese word for kelp, and it's a bit thicker than other varieties. And interestingly, it's said that if you add dried kelp to a pot of dry beans, it will help tenderize the beans in the cooking water.
Okay, now, listeners know that if they've been tuning in for years and years, that every time you come on, we get to taste things. But during the pandemic, that has gotten very difficult because we're not sitting next to each other, and so you don't get to cook delicious things for me and for Robin and for Tanya to eat. However, you have found a workaround, which is called sending something through the mail. And that's what you've done. And you've sent me a couple of different kinds of seaweed here. Let's see. There's a seaweed salad that I've got in front of me. It's in a jar that I've had in the fridge.
Yeah, give that a taste. So this is a fermented seaweed salad. You've probably had seaweed salad before you order sushi. Mm-hmm. This is also from Atlantic Sea Farms. It's made with this Maine kelp, and it is fresh and crunchy. You'll notice that the green is much brighter than a lot of seaweed salads, which actually are made with dye. It's got ginger and scallions and sesame seeds and tamari. I love this stuff.
I have to say, after even tasting it, I'm like ready for like a roll of sushi right now because it's putting me in
I'm sorry I didn't
space.
Send you that, Jeremy. That'll be our next segment.
You've also got a kimchi seaweed thing here.
I do. I know you like spicy foods. This is Atlantic Sea Farm's sea chai, their play on a mild kimchi. Again, raw kelp, Napa cabbage, daikon, fish sauce. I love this stuff as well. With grilled summer foods, it would be really delicious.
Absolutely.
Another cool thing about this company is that they created it to fill in a gap in the Maine lobster industry. Lobstering, one of the Maine's most important industries, has been hit really hard, and demand for lobsters has fallen sharply because of COVID, restaurants closing and scaling back. And so what they do is they offer free kelp seeds to lobster men and women. And when these lobster fishermen are in the off season, they plant these kelp seeds on ropes, and then the company buys the seaweed from them. And the seaweed farming gives these fishermen a chance to have a year-round income in an industry that's really been hard hit.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I assume that this stuff is very good for you.
Oh, my goodness. You ready for this? I mean, loaded with potassium, magnesium, vitamin B12, iodine, omega-3 fatty acids, and tons of calcium and antioxidants. And the owner of the company, Brianna, described it to me as an umami bomb of taste. It's briny. It's sweet. It's meaty. So it's, good for you, but it's also delicious. But best of all is how adaptable it is in so many different types of recipes.
Okay, and we're going to put those recipes from you at hereandnow.org, but let's talk about one of them. This recipe that you have uses seaweed on grilled corn. There's seaweed butter.
Exactly. It might sound odd, but I strip the corn of the husk, but I don't take it off. I remove the silk, and I grill it until it just blackens. And then you can do this with dried seaweed, any type you like, or you can use this fresh kelp. And I just mixed it with softened butter. You could add chili flakes, grated lime zest, and you put a touch of this seaweed butter on this smoky grilled corn, and it's briny and delicious, and the corn and the seaweed get along very well.
This summer for me has been all about corn on the cob. I'm enjoying it so much. So that sounds like a great one. You've also got an omelet recipe that uses zucchini, a vegetable that a lot of gardeners have this time of year.
Yes, and a lot of excess zucchini as well. This is loosely based on a traditional Japanese omelet called tamagoyaki. I hope I've said that right. I had never had it. I thought, what if you sautéed zucchini and seaweed, and then you whisked eggs with sesame oil and soy sauce and made a flat omelet? You just let it sit, you flip it over once, and then I serve it with a little sautéed seaweed on top. And I was shocked at how good it was alone. You could cut it into strips and add it to fried rice on top of ramen or soup. Really simple 10-minute recipe, but really redefines an omelet.
Okay, and just about 30 seconds here, Kathy, but I know that you've got a ginger kelp green juice use for seaweed.
I do. Super, super nutritious. It's from friend food writer Mindy Fox. I also have a cucumber miso kelp dip that you whirl up in the blender in 5 minutes. Really good summer dip.
All right, well, we will post these all at hereandnow.org so everyone can get their seaweed fix for the summer. Kathy Gunst, Here and Now resident chef, thank you as always.
Great to talk to you, Jeremy.
And by the way, this kimchi sea chi that I've got is very good.
The coronavirus pandemic has left countries across the world in crisis. Some governments are using the crisis as a chance to wield more power. 10 days ago in Zimbabwe in southern Africa, police stormed the home of one of the country's most respected investigative journalists and arrested him. His name is Hopewell Chinono. Chinono recently exposed a scandal that involves Zimbabwe's health minister allegedly awarding contracts for personal protective gear at inflated cost. The journalist knew he was a target. Earlier this month, he told an interviewer that fear wouldn't stop him.
I've reached a point where I say to myself, whether I'm scared, terrified, or living in fear, it makes no difference. Because if someone wants to get to me, whether I'm bold or whether I'm scared, they'll still get to me. So I've decided to say, I'll just soldier on.
That's Hopewell Chinono. The government arrested him exactly 2 weeks later. Dewa Mavinga is the South Africa director for Human Rights Watch. He's on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for having me on the show. Thank you.
People in this country likely don't know Hopewell Chinono's name. How prominent, though, is he in Zimbabwe?
Hopewell Chinono is a very prominent journalist in Zimbabwe. He is one of the very few journalists in the country who had access to accurate information about high-level corruption in the procurement of COVID-19 equipment by the government involving the Minister of Health. Money which was stolen was worth over $60 million. And as a result of that expose by Hopewell, the Minister of Health in Zimbabwe was fired from his job. But now the government is taking it out on Hopewell, making him pay for exposing that corruption.
We should say that you're in a position to tell us exactly what is happening now in Zimbabwe, because your organization, Human Rights Watch, just reported that Zimbabwe has 8 million people, 8 million who don't have enough food, more than 4 million who don't have enough water, and leadership, you say, is not stepping in. So where does that leave a journalist like Chinono, who does step in and investigate what happens? How vulnerable is someone like him?
At the moment, Hopewell Chinono is very vulnerable because he is a fearless, courageous journalist who confronted a government that is not willing to respect human rights, to respect the rule of law and good governance. So for exposing corruption, instead of protecting him, the government of Zimbabwe has turned on him, arrested him on false allegations that he was inciting violence and on Twitter. And yet there is not a single tweet that the government could produce that had anything to do with violence.
Hopewell has been in touch with his legal team. You've been in touch with his legal team. What do you know about how he's faring personally right now?
Well, Hopewell is very strong, and he has sent a message that he will not be bowed, he will not give up, and that the fight against corruption must go on. But Hopewell is living in conditions, in detention, squalid conditions, where there is not enough access to running water, where there is overcrowding in the cells, and also the transport that he uses from prison to the courts. And that puts Hopewell and others at high risk of contracting COVID-19.
The arrest of Hopewell Chinono has received a lot of attention abroad. There are organizations, including the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard, calling for his release. And I will say that I have a personal interest here. Hopewell and I were Nieman Fellows together about 10 years ago. Do the international calls from the Nieman Foundation, from your organization, Human Rights Watch, do they do any good?
Absolutely. The international calls for the release of Hopewell and others are very important because they put the spotlight on Zimbabwe. And the Zimbabwe government has been trying to portray and project an image of a new dispensation since the removal of former President Robert Mugabe in 2017. So it is very important that the pressure is kept on so that they will do the right thing and ensure the release of Hopewell and the respect of his rights and that of other journalists in Zimbabwe who are also seeking simply to do their work without harassment.
But there seems to be no indication he's going to be released. He's scheduled for trial in August, which means he will have been in this filthy prison for weeks. What kind of hope do you have?
Well, speaking to his legal team, they are going back to court. They have appealed against the denial of bail for Hopewell. But we need to keep speaking out to ensure that his rights are protected and so that also he knows that he has the support and solidarity from within Zimbabwe and also from within the international community.
Dewa Mavinga is the Southern Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.